Hello, everyone. I'm Eugene Porter De Leon at Porter De Leon on Twitter, and welcome to episode 122 of In Tech We Trust. Today, we explore the relationship between tech workers and the companies they work for through a lens focused more on the human aspect.
You know, if you're clear about what you're doing and what you want to do and what you need to do, you'll straighten your boss out. You'll straighten their boss out. I watched in a large aerospace organization a mid-level person change the purpose of that company.
And we discuss why there seems to be a persistent gap between opportunities in tech that are provided to women versus men.
The coders had done their own study on how many times their code gets accepted as compared to their male counterparts. And, you know, of course it came out that obviously the male counterparts were getting more code in and getting more bonuses because of it, things like that.
Also, how much influence do these technology companies have on our professional and personal lives? And what responsibilities fall on them with regards to the people they employ and the tech community as a whole?
I don't think you should or can depend solely on your employer. You know, even if the employer has the best culture in the world, the best intentions, cares about its employees, ultimately the company has to take care of itself, and you need it more than it needs you.
So, how much can you depend on the company you work for? How much do you rely on the companies you buy from? What do you think the responsibility of any company is to ensure that workers have a place to, well, work? And why is it so acceptable for so many companies to deny opportunities, turn a blind eye to cultural dysfunction, or even lay off workers in the name of shareholder value? In 2016, over 330 layoffs were planned within the tech sector, yet the technology-laden NASDAQ exchange reached an all-time record high in that same year. So where's the disconnect? Why can tech leaders lay off thousands of workers but still keep their bonuses? Why can companies raise prices to boost revenue and not put that revenue back into the people who work for them? And how important is this to you? And that's the theme of our show today, dependability. So how dependable do you think tech companies need to be? Well, let's find out.
In tech we trust. We're not sure about.
But first, we have David Allen at GTD Guy on Twitter, world-renowned author of Getting Things Done, aka GTD Methodology, and executive coach to some of the world's top minds in tech and elsewhere. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eddie. Happy to be here.
Great to talk to you again. So, David, tech companies like any are not sentient beings unto themselves. They're simply a collection of individuals with varied degrees of skill and experience. Now, an interesting article came out recently in the Harvard Business Review stating that employee burnout is a problem with the company and not the person, which puts forth an argument from the book Time, Talent, and Energy that when employees aren't as productive as they could be, it's usually the organization, not its employees, that are to blame. Now, I imagine it's a little bit of both. David, what would you say to that argument that the company policy, culture, leadership is more responsible than the employee when it comes to productivity?
There's a big yes to both of those. You know, first of all, and you can go back to Deming. You know, if you got a funky system, I don't care how productive your employees are, there's a big improvement opportunity. So the systemic improvements, you know, are huge in terms of just being able to create more effective and optimized output. If you have individuals, however, that are not personally accountable, productive, and have the best practices of being able to get things done that are handed off to them as accountabilities and responsibilities and actions they and projects they need to handle, then you got a big problem there too. So you could have a highly effective system and highly ineffective people, and it sucks. Or you can have highly effective people and an ineffective system, and it sucks. Either way. And I've seen both, and I've seen combinations and hybrids of all of that all over the place. Yeah, you know, I've researched for years what's the best organizational structure that allows highly effective people to operate. That's why I've been, you know, implementing Holacracy for 6 years, sort of the self-organizing organization model. You can attack it from both sides. I have generally over the last 35 years attacked it from the personal side, because if people get accountable for themselves and can manage themselves highly effectively, then they can start to recognize when things are ineffective systemically and will take accountability and responsibility to fix it, change it, or leave. You know, it depends on who you're talking to and for what purpose.
And well, in your experience, what are sort of the biggest barriers? And as you know, I'm a GTD practitioner and very much involved in the methodology, and have benefited quite a lot, and have run into my own barriers for where the methodology works great in the individual, but the culture, leadership, you know, policies, et cetera, of an organization, as you pointed out, may not be the most effective environment for someone who's trying to be extremely effective. Where are you seeing where some of the disconnects can be, where someone who is, highly organized, effective, gets basically a lot of roadblocks or gets tripped up a lot or gets pushed back from an organization that's not highly effective, not highly organized?
Well, come on. If you're focused on outcomes and actions about anything that you're engaged with or have any potential accountability with or potential meaning about, whether that's a meeting you've been invited to go to, whether that's something you've been tasked by your boss to do or whatever, if you're sitting there going, excuse me, what are they asking me to do here? What exactly is the outcome? What's my project here? I get to mark this off as done when what's true. Wait a minute, what's my next step? I need to talk to my boss. I don't think they're clear about what they want. Let me go manage that. And if the individual starts to take accountability, man, they can get a lot of people highly, much more focused on what they need. I've discovered, and strangely, over the years, that if you're clear about what you're doing and what you want to do and what you need to do, you'll straighten your boss out. You'll straighten their boss out. I watched in a large aerospace organization a mid-level person change the purpose of that company because she got real clear that something ought to be included in it, and she just would not let go until she just kept moving that forward until somebody said no and they finally said yes and it became part of the corporate purpose. I mean, this is huge. So anybody who takes accountability for themselves in terms of their own 10 acres and starts to move that forward, no matter what they're encountering, sure, there are challenges and numbness and bureaucracy and all those kind of things. But you either give up and play victim to that, or you say, I'm going to change what I can change. And I'll find out, I'm going to get to a no as soon as I can. it's a good sales process, but, that's how you make anything happen in this, sort of numbnut, unconscious world.
I think that's a great thread to pull on, and I want to unpack that a little bit, because I think that's one thing that discourages a lot of people who feel like they've got the right answer or they know what is right to do, but they can't package it within a construct or methodology that then gets people to understand and gets people on board. But when you look at something and you clarify with things, and then you help make sure that you walk them along that path, and I've whiteboarded this out a bunch of times, to get clarity, to then organize that, to reflect and then gauge, everyone starts to get in that mindset, and they start saying it's hard for them to resist something that makes so much sense that then they get pushed in a direction of okay, well, this is the right way to go, or let's clarify this.
Or it just gets so constipated the people then leave.
Yeah.
And I believe me, I've seen a lot of that.
I think one of the most interesting stories I think a lot of people can relate to that you had articulated on in I think several of your talks is this woman coming who was a leader. She came out of a meeting, I think she was new to the organization, and it was a great quote. I think she said something to the effect that after she got out, there wasn't really an outcomes or next actions. It was basically, she came out and said that, well, that was like the largest pile of amorphous undoables I've ever seen.
Yeah, she was actually talking about that, about her own to-do list, but it's absolutely true what most people walk out with their meeting notes.
Tech companies, who felt like they were, fast and agile, and some of them can be, but they're nowhere near immune to this phenomena of a bunch of people piling in a room, sounding really smart or wanting to sound really smart, and then walking out with absolutely nothing to show for it.
Well, if you want to take the other side of this, then, based on my experience, organizations can actually structure their own operational systems so that they're actually requiring or asking of all the individuals to take accountability for that kind of action. which is what the self-organizing models that are showing up now these days, is that, you know, hey, I need to hire people who take that kind of accountability. And I'm going to expect of them to be doing those kind of behaviors if things don't work. Don't sit there and play victim and complain. Bring it up, and here's the process that makes that safe and available to do. And I think that's the organizational accountability to create an environment where that's much safer to make those things happen.
I think that's a fascinating point. It's something that I've thought about a lot and talked to people about a lot, and is this sort of either virtuous circle or vicious cycle where you have people who have, A, not been trained to be managers, leaders, or not trained in a methodology to organize themselves, and therefore can't execute, and therefore then can't pass that knowledge off to the people they mentor. And then in the same time, don't understand how to hire people that think in that way, that operate in that way, just as you had outlined. And so then you have this constant sort of, you know, vicious cycle of more of the same people who don't quite know how to, you know, to do this get hired. They don't find out how to do it while they're there. They get moved into leadership positions, and then they continue that cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. And Yadin, let's add an important sidebar here. Virtual companies, where they're now having to hire people who have to be accountable to how do they manage themselves, because they can't go hang out and complain at the coffee machine. There's no space. They have to be accountable, and that has to be real clear what they need to be producing. And so that puts the virtual world out there is putting huge new demands on both the individuals to be able to step up to the plate, take those kind of accountabilities, and to the organization to be able to make sure that you're getting those kind of people, and you're also giving them permission and building structures so they have a voice.
That's a huge requirement for a lot of the people who work remotely.
Well, this is not a matter of, it's not a matter of whether, it's a matter of when. Come on, just look.
I guess some
organizations will be, you know, another 200 years before they're virtual, and some will be the next 2 months.
So. And some are going the other direction. IBM just recently asked a lot of its workers who were remote to come back and move to one of the offices.
Yeah, but even when you're there physically, and I understand the hybrid version really works and is very cool, and I think is going to be important and functional, highly functional, but only if you have individuals who are willing to work virtually. You have a bunch of people that, see, you need both. If you only could do one, you know, you're screwed professionally. In other words, you've limited yourself in terms of your availability. You need to be able to do both. Just like you need to be able to have the flexibility to be visionary and execution oriented. You need the flexibility to be able to go, okay, I am now, you know, face to face with people in a real time, real life space and time environment, and make that work and take advantage of that. At the same time, I need to stop for the next half day and go home and do these 14 things that I need to do. Get out of my face, guys. And so the willingness and the ability to be able to do that, you're probably one too. That then works. You don't want to have to resist any of these professional environments. Unfortunately, rules are made when brains run out. So, you know, everybody tries to then create these, okay, no email after 9 or before, you know, call, come on, give me a break, you know, grow up, you know. And so they're trying to create rules out there. And I understand where they're coming from. These bureaucracies are trying to create these, you know, rules and templates that they think are going to improve the situation. But unfortunately, they're usually done because of uneducated, unsophisticated, unaware, and unself-controllable people that then they try to make rules and structures to try to prevent the mistakes those people make.
One final point I want to sort of hit is something that I think a lot of the listeners could benefit from, and that's some perspective on next steps. A lot of people have run into a lot of the issues, and we've kind of outlined a lot of the big ones right now. I mean, other than, of course, you know, I would wholeheartedly, you know, tell everyone, go read the book, Getting Things Done, you know, The Secrets to Stress-Free Productivity, The Life, Universe, and Everything, as I call it. But what do you think of the next steps is there? Someone's frustrated. They want to just take that first step and say, you know, look around them, open their eyes, and kind of what can they do within the organization to say, okay, here's what I see is broken, and here's the first thing I can do is just with my, like as you said, you're my own 10 acres to start moving it in the right direction.
Right. Well, the first decision you need to make is this an actionable thing? Is this something I think that a potential change could happen if I actually did something? Yes or no? Call a thunderstorm coming up, think you can change that? No. So you accept it, ignore it, or play with it. That's what you do with things that you assume there's nothing to do about it. Usually people complain about things that they assume need to be different. They're just not willing to take a risk to make it so. So anytime you're complaining, you say, well, wait, what would you like to have happen? And that doesn't mean that you think you have the power to change the situation to your ideal scene. It does mean you have the power to look into whether that's possible. So what's the next thing you need to do to find out whether there's anything you could do about this or not? And that's usually the question people avoid, especially people playing the victim or complaining mode.
It's much more comfortable to be in that mode than to actually say, okay, what's that, you know, what can I change and what's that next action look like? What is it?
Oh, sure. You get to, your ego gets to play that I'm really an important big person, but the, you know, these people have screwed me up and not given me the opportunity to show how well I could do. No, come on, grow up.
So that's the next action item is grow up.
Well no, the next act, no, the next action is actually to be a child and go, well, wait a minute. Hey, wait, where's my ball? How do I get my ball? Right. So what's the next thing you would need to do to find out whether there actually is anything you could do? And maybe the next step is to talk to somebody and say, hey, do you think there's anything I can do about this? But there's something. You know, if you don't know what to do about anything, just pick up the phone, you know, punch 7 or 9 or 10 numbers at random and see who answers. Say, hey, do you know how to, I would handle something like this? And if they say no, say thanks. Do you know anybody who might? Within 6 calls, you'll be at the Pope. So you're not far from any help.
I'm gonna try that.
Yeah, just try it. I think 6.
Get a hold of the Pope.
6 or 7 or 8 or something like that. But it's like you're not that far from anybody on the planet in terms of, you know, 3 degrees or 6 degrees or 2 degrees of connection, you know, that we've all got out there. So all you have to do is step in the plate. Are you going to get in the driver's seat or are you going to get run over by your horse? You know, it's in a sense that simple, but that requires a huge sort of maturity to say, wait a minute, this thing that's bothering me, what would I need to do to get this off my mind? What do I need to do to relieve the pressure on this? And it may be to find out there's nothing you could do about this, in which case you accept it, ignore it, or play with it. That's what you do with gravity and things like that you can't change, but that are killing people as we speak. You can't do anything about those, so you didn't wake up this morning and say, oh my God, gravity sucks. You know, the reason is you just assume gravity's there. So anything you assume, okay, senior management politics, I'm sorry, that's a given. You think you're going to change that? You think you're going to get rid of that? Give me a break. The degree to which you complain about it is the degree to which you ignore strategizing within it. So step in the driver's seat, you know, or not.
And I think that's an excellent framework. The more you complain, the less you're spending time strategizing. Well, David, this was a great conversation. Fantastic insight as always. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with our listeners. Thank you for joining the show.
My pleasure, Yoni. Thanks for the invitation.
Next on the show, I talk with Lauren Malhoit, at Malhoit on the Twitters, about the pay gaps that we're seeing between men and women in the tech world. Now, Lauren, this was something that was going on for some time across many, if not all, industries, but this was illustrated most recently in a story about pay gaps that were quite extreme in the case of Google. Google's now being accused of systematic compensation disparities. Lauren, what's your take on this?
I mean, it's interesting because Google is saying absolutely not. They, you know, every year they go through and make sure that their practices are fair, I guess, and equal. But the Department of Labor actually just went through and said, of course, it's not. And of course, Google is subject to this because they do work with the Department of Labor. So they have to go through some of these analytics exercises. It's a weird climate right now. I think women are pissed right now, honestly, and I've noticed it kind of getting worse and worse. I don't know if it's, you know, political. I don't know what exactly it is, or if it's just, you know, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore type of thing. But you, I just read an article from Facebook too, and the coders had done their own study on how many times their code gets accepted as compared to their male counterparts. And, you know, of course it came out that obviously the male counterparts were getting more code in and getting more bonuses because of it, things like that. And Facebook's answer to that was that actually it's because they accept more senior level people's code more often, which I don't know how that's an answer because that begs the question. Well, so why are any women in senior positions?
There's a cycle there. So it's right. Like, well, there's not any senior position, you know, women senior positions. So therefore women aren't going to get more senior positions because there aren't other women to foster them getting more senior positions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's like kind of the same old argument. And it's interesting because that actually is part of an argument that I've heard where people argue, let's say there's a, you should let let market forces basically kind of determine these things, like, mm-hmm. you know, like salary negotiations or promotions. And I think that's an old argument where they're saying you don't need to put artificial constructs or frameworks or rules in place in order to, you know, to foster good work. Good work will just float to the top. I mean, what would you say to that, Lauren?
I get all of the old school, you know, I read Why Men Make More, and some of it is because of, you know, men are usually able to travel more. What is it called in this article, like the mommy conspiracy or something like that. I forget what they called it. It was actually pretty poignant. But, you know, there are reasons why men do make more, and things like just being able to negotiate better, being taught to ask for what they want. So I think there are some societal things. I don't think that the work, like the best work boiling to the top is always the way to go. I mean, I think we all know in every industry that really networking, you know, human networking is the way you get to the top. And hopefully you can prove yourself along the way and, you know, be a good performer. But we all know that not all good performers are, you know, your boss.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, some really revealing stuff. I mean, like GeekWire came out with a survey really recently was revealing. And then Forbes also had, or actually Fortune, I should say, had a really interesting argument talking about how women who are younger get hit the most in the tech gender pay gap. In this article, the tech gender pay gap hits younger women the hardest, and with women under 25 earning an average of 29% less. And this comes from the salary database Comparably. And then the women now who are going into the workforce have fewer, which boggled my mind. They're saying they have fewer role models and women in senior positions than women did when they were first joining the workforce. You know, those women who are now in their 50s, back when they first joined the workforce, they had more women role models and people in senior positions and mentors. And this just seems counterintuitive to me because it seems like things were getting better, but maybe, I mean, the data is not showing it. Data is showing that the pay gap's increasing at certain places, and in certain places it's getting worse.
Yeah, it's actually on the decline. And Black and Latina women actually, I think, have it the very worst when it comes to
LGBTQ women mm-hmm. as well.
And I haven't experienced that myself. I think, you know, being gay has actually helped me in my career. But, you know, that's
excellent.
That's, I guess, something that can be debated.
Are you the equal opportunity poster child?
Exactly. But, you know, I'll admit it. But, you know, I think there is a lot to be said about, for instance, I was reading this article in TechCrunch from the American Association of University Women, and they're saying that it might take another 136 years for the pay gap to disappear entirely, which is an extremely long time, right? But if we're on the decline as well, I don't even know how that's possible because we're actually kind of regressing and heading further away. And then when you think, you know, we all talk about hiring women and getting young women into STEM and all that, but a real problem, and you kind of hinted at this, is actually retention, you know, getting them to stay past the 10, the 15, the 20 year mark, getting them into leadership positions. A lot of women just say, you know what, screw it. Like, I don't want to deal with this anymore. And they get completely out of the field. And so that does lead to problems with mentorship and, you know, kind of that good old girls club, you know? And so I don't have a huge problem with the good old boys club as long as we have our own clubs too, you know? Again, I think networking is the way to do business. That's just how it is.
I know. And in pretty much any industry, those tribes really matter. And mm-hmm. so... And to get, I mean, tribal mentality isn't that great, but, you know, positive tribes, positive human networks, those actually really do matter tremendously. And I think to your point, Lauren, that you're seeing an erosion of some of those, you know, female networks within the tech industry, and that's actually causing some real damage.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I don't know. I mean, do men lives matter though, Yadin?
Yeah, all lives matter. So where's the men in tech movement? We had neither men in tech. Wait, I think this was called tech.
I think that's it. Hopefully we don't get a bunch of angry emails.
Hey, I
say any Twitter engagement's good engagement. So, well, Lauren, this is a huge topic, and I think we're just scratching the surface on this. I think we could spend a whole entire show, but I want to say thanks for joining, and thanks for uncovering a little more detail and digging a little bit deeper on this topic.
Hey, thank you, Yadin.
I had the chance to talk to John Troyer at Jay Troyer on Twitter, co-CEO of Tech Reckoning and the Influencer Marketing Council, about what he thinks an organization's responsibility is to develop people and actually provide them a dependable stream of income and opportunity for growth, advancements, etc., and as well as how tech workers have had to evolve to compensate for what companies are not providing in this arena. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So a lot of people will definitely know you from your podcast, The Geek Whisperers, one of the early podcasts I became a fan of. And so I wanted to chat with you about what your opinions slash experience has been with companies and how you feel they need to be dependable in certain categories, like career advancement, like making sure that you've, you know, got a steady income. What do you think their responsibility is?
You know, I think we can put to rest this dependency notion right away.
There's no dependability.
I don't think you can, you should or can depend solely on your employer. You know, even if the employer has the best culture in the world, the best intentions, cares about its employees, you know, ultimately the company has to take care of itself, and you need it more than it needs you. If a business downturn happens, if a change in strategy happens, you know, your job could change or be eliminated. In a industry like IT and tech, change is constant, right? We work for 40, 50 years. If you can imagine an IT worker 40 or 50 years ago and what they did and what you do now, and then project it on, right, 40 or 50 years in the future, right, that is a remarkable path. Something that came up once on the Geek Whisperers was a great quote that basically was like, look, IT is a constantly changing profession. You'll have to continually learn new skills. There are other professions where one does not have to learn new skills, right? You can dig ditches. There are other things, that places where you don't need to be learning all the time. But IT is a place where you need to be learning. So what we've seen as a common theme in the guests that we've interviewed has been, one, you don't have to follow your passion, but you need to find something in your current job that you can be passionate about, right? Something you can find interesting and do really well on. That's one element of a recipe for either sticking around or finding your next gig. And then two, you have to be looking up from what you're currently doing and looking around and seeing what's the next thing or where could you add value. And you have to cultivate that curiosity. Those are the people who develop new skills, who are lifelong learners, and who can step from stone to stone in the creek.
And so that kind of that follows the saying, whereas there's no one responsible for you except for you. Is that kind of fitting in that bucket? And is that, you think that's 100%, or you think there's maybe like an 80-20 rule there, where maybe 20% of that responsibility kind of falls on the organization, but 80% of it really falls on you?
Well, look, you depend on your employer for a check, and you know, you trust your employer, but ultimately you're the CEO of your own life. And just as how you have to figure out how to navigate your marriage and your kids and, you know, what you eat every day and how you stay healthy, you have to navigate your career. And no one's going to do that for you. You can get support. There are many companies who, you know, care very deeply about their employees, and not all do, but many do. And many jobs last for many years. But ultimately, you have to decide whether to stay, whether to go, what to do, even if you stay in a current role, how to keep yourself relevant, how to keep adding value, and again, finding that part of the job that you can be passionate about.
You know, and I definitely agree with that. I think some people feel very strongly that the organization has a much, much bigger responsibility, and, you know, to be dependable, to be there if you're willing to put the work in, if you're willing to give up, sacrifice parts of your life, your time for money, that there's that responsibility that the organization should be there for you. But I think that is dying. I think that's a perspective that will definitely leave people behind and also leave them very, very frustrated. I think there was this one analogy that was given, and I think you described it on one of your shows as well, where there's just basically a Venn diagram between you, your time, your experience, and there's an overlay between the company, the brand, their resources, and their reach within an industry.
And the overlap in that, those two, you know, the circles, that that Venn diagram is, you know, what was described as riding the wave. And I think if people look at it that way, where it's more of, you know, a symbiotic relationship where, you know, the organization has something, you have something, and together you're able to accomplish something. That I think then dispels a lot of, you know, a lot of the perspective or the misconceptions that, that the company owes you something, or that, you know, even conversely, that you owe the company something, or that you're obligated to be dependable, to be there for the company when they need you.
There is a mutual dependence, right? You promise to show up at work and give it your best every day. And they promise to, you know, pay you. So there is a mutual dependence.
Yeah,
and there are people who...
There's a reason people show up.
Yeah, and people are unscrupulous, and people are immoral, and people do get screwed over. So I don't want to say that that never happens either. But, you know, and there's a way of a partnership. I think a lot of times somebody will come out of college and they'll get their first job and they'll fall in love, right? They will give it their all. They're so excited. They're working. They're adding value. They're valued by their boss and by management. I remember my first job, I thought about getting a tattoo. Like, I thought I should get a tattoo of this logo on my back to to signify what a rocking job this is.
I think there's some NetApp people that have those.
Well, now 3, 4, 5 jobs later, and in fact, 2 or 3 careers later, like, I don't look at it that way anymore. I do think there's an ethical and moral responsibility for both sides, you know, to stand up to what they promised. But dependency, that's a challenging word.
It is tough. And I think what people have a hard time with is a lot of the dysfunction they see, which is caused by individuals within organizations that say, for example, small groups of upper management that want to keep bonuses in order to accomplish that, you know, that keeping of that bonus, they'll fire 100 people or 1,000 people or 5,000 people. And those layoffs will, you know, either be in under the guise of, you know, increasing shareholder value, or, you know, ensuring that the upper management, you know, hits their bottom line numbers and gets their bonus in. And I know that that type of dysfunction is, you know, is abhorred pretty much universally. But do you think that's something that the management of a company owes, you know, to the employees not to do? Do they owe it to them not to make those types of decisions in order to increase shareholder value, or to ensure that, you know, the executives, you know, hit their bottom line numbers and you know,
look, again, owing something, that's a challenging term, right? I think that there are some ethical and moral reasons why they shouldn't do things like that, and they shouldn't screw over their employees. But owe it to you, I mean, that implies there's some implications there that I'm uncomfortable with. There is a skill set to work and managing your environment. And I think sometimes techies say, oh, I don't want to be political, it's all politics, and they just brush it off or don't deal with it. I just do my job. And in fact, politics is a bad word too, but you have to know how to manage up to your boss, right? You have to know how to demonstrate that you're doing the right thing. You have to be the person, if you want to stay in the job while other people are being laid off, you have to be the person that people think gets stuff done. Now, that's not to say, right? Layoffs happen all the time through no fault of your own. I know many people who were laid off, maybe not even through malfeasance, Yadin, right? It can be just that the company isn't doing what your team is doing anymore, right? So in many circumstances, no guilt, no finger pointing. But I don't think you can, in 2017, depend on your company for a lifelong employment.
I would definitely agree with you there. Well, John, thanks for jumping on the show with us today. I appreciate your perspective, and I hope the listeners do as well. And hope you can join the show again sometime.
Oh, would love to. It was a lot of fun.
And that's our show for this week. If you haven't subscribed already, please do so on iTunes or on the podcatcher of your choice, and leave us a review if you will. It helps others find us. Also, we want to hear from you. Your story ideas, your thoughts on the tech world and what you're doing as well, so that we can make this show as relevant for your daily tech life as possible. So hit us up on the Twitter using #InTechWeTrust. We'll be checking that now daily to start conversations, engage with people, and get your thoughts. You can also follow us at @InTech_WeTrust on the Twitters and give us your thoughts there as well. See you next time. Yeah.